everyone. This is Kat Caldwell, and you are listening to Pencils and Lipstick. And today is May 6th, and this is episode 229. This is going to be an interview episode with Cheryl Gray Bostrom. She is a women's fiction writer. I am so excited to always have such an range of authors on this show. So Cheryl is coming out with a new book called Leaning on Air, which we talk a lot about. And she also has a book called Sugar Birds. And since she has spent most of her life in the Pacific Northwest and is a naturalist and a photographer and a poet, that all kind of goes into her work, which I really enjoy listening to. And I think it's something that we can all learn from. I think everything that you are passionate about should be, or at least should be allowed to be, part of your writing as well. So Cheryl Gray Bostrom, I have a lot of hard time saying her last name. The links will be in the show notes, but it is B-O-S-T-R-O-M Bostrom, has appeared in a variety of publications, including the American Scientific Affiliation's God and Nature magazine, for which she's a regular photo essayist. Sugar Birds, her first book, has already garnered recognition that includes a number of key industry awards, with a Carroll Award, Christianity Today's Fiction Award of Merit, and Christie Award finalist honors among them. Ooh, that's so cool. So her link will be in the show notes below, but it is CherylBostrom.com. And we are going to talk a lot about just the writing process, about women's fiction. Women's fiction is a funny genre because it encompasses a lot. And it hasn't, as far as I have seen, niched down enough. I mean, sometimes you think like the romance genre has possibly niched down too much. But I feel like the women's genre should niche down a little bit more. So if you are a women's fiction writer, if you are a Christian fiction writer, if you are just maybe a naturalist as well and have other interests, creative interests other than your writing, and you want to see how Cheryl sort of brings in her love of nature into her books, I think that this episode is going to be for you. At the moment, I am recording this intro early because as you listen to this entire week, I will be in Cuba. So I am going there on a missions trip. We are bringing a lot of supplies, and we're bringing some just hope, hopefully, to people. Cuba is not doing so well at the moment, just like a lot of places on earth. And I have carved out this little bit of time to go do something that I love doing, going to another country, seeing another culture. And once again, kind of like what we did in Nepal, using the travel for something else other than just seeing. As much as I love to travel and I love seeing other people and I love just sort of being immersed in the culture, this is a real opportunity to feel like giving back, I guess, to the people. I'm excited to meet new people. And maybe I'll get a Cuban accent in my Spanish. I don't know. We will see. It'll be fun. I have little toys that I'm bringing for the kids. A friend of mine told me that there is a house, Hemingway had a house. Was it Hemingway? Who had a house in Havana? I'm not sure that I will have time. I do get one day to explore Havana, but you know, I try not to set too many expectations when I'm going with a group of people that I don't know too well. You know, once you're part of a group, if you're not the leader, my theory is you just follow along and you don't cause stress to others, right? So it's going to be fun. I will be excited to report back. You probably won't get a report back until two more episodes, because I'm about to pre-record next week's intro as well, just to make sure that when I get back, hopefully I won't be sick. I pray I won't be sick, honestly, but you never know. Traveling brings up all sorts of surprises, right? So I'll give you guys a little report back on, let's see, episode 231. So I'll leave that intro I'll record that after Cuba and I'll give you guys a little insight. Again, if you like the show, if you're enjoying listening to all the amazing people that are on Pencils and Lipstick, please share it with other writers or people that just like listening to authors talking about their books. Giving a review on whatever platform you listen to is always helpful. And there are links below in which you can sign up for my writer's newsletter or my reader's newsletter. And follow me on whatever social media you wish to follow me on. Especially if you want writing tips, follow me, get on my writer's newsletter. And if you want to hear about what I'm reading and what I'm writing in the sense of like books that are coming out, get on my reader's newsletter because the Bended Duet is on pre-order already. Bended Loyalty is on pre-order. And once I get back from Cuba and format Bended Love, that will be on pre-order as well. So actually, I'll probably just put it up. Yeah, Bended Love is on pre-order. I'll just put that up for you guys. Anyway, the links are below. You guys should go down there. You should also follow me on BookBub because Instagram decided to knock me off for like 4 days and then bring me back on and whatever. They're just not to be trusted, y'all. So you should follow me on BookBub as well. I try to get all those links in there for you. All right, let's get into the show. Of course, if you guys ever have somebody that you want on the podcast, if you want to hear from your favorite author, or writer, or you want to be on the show because you are a writer, you can just contact me through any social media. I'm mostly on Instagram, Facebook. I'm a little bit on X, but not a whole lot. Anyway, there's lots of ways to. You can go to catcaldwell.com. That always gets straight to me on the contact form, even the spam. Anyway, please don't spam me. So let's get into the interview. I think that you will enjoy this talk with Cheryl Gray Bostrom. All right, today I have with me Cheryl Gray Bostrom. I don't know why that was a bit of a tongue twister, but thank you, Cheryl, for coming on the show. Before we get into your book, Leaning on Air, and your first book, Sugar Birds, will you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Kat. I'm a Northwest, Pacific Northwest girl, born and raised, and have lived here for most of my life, apart from a time when in my early childhood, we moved up and down the coast a bit. But I love photography. I'm a naturalist, according to those who love the natural world and who like what I do with it. But I'm a former English teacher, and
Okay.
I've done a variety of things. I'm married to a large animal veterinarian, and we live
Ooh.
in the country outside of a little town called Linden. And yeah, published in a lot of different venues, publications. And then as I approached 60, I realized that I wanted to write fiction. And
Okay.
so I made the jump from having written excuse me, having written two books, two nonfiction long form works 20 years earlier, to learning everything I could about the craft. And I didn't know what I didn't know. I had a master's
Yeah.
in English, and I taught kids how to write forever, and then I got into this whole new world, and it's just magnificent. So
That's amazing. So you had no real ambition of fiction writing before 60?
I would say I had I can remember at 10 telling my family that I was going to be writing novels someday. And then when I was in college, we had there I don't know if you remember Bob Hope.
Yes, I love him.
So in college there were a few of us that got to be in this Bob Hope show that was that when he came onto our campus. And so then he interviewed us, and he asked me, so what do you want to do? And I said, oh, I would just love to write a novel. And so this is when I would have been about, I don't know, about 20, but I think
That's so cool.
it terrified me, just
Yeah.
terrified me.
Yeah. That's so cool that you were on his show. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. In fact, they had a got a color TV when I was like a preteen. And they only had, we were only allowed to watch certain channels. I think they only had three channels, honestly. But we
Right.
watched a lot of black and white movies, and Bob Hope is one of my favorite. I think the kids miss out a lot on not watching black and white movies and that sort of like clean humor, you know, that it's different, but it's so funny and it's more intelligent, I feel like, than the humor these days. Maybe they wouldn't know.
It doesn't depend on it doesn't depend on so much on sarcasm, for instance, or on degradation of either a cause or a person. It's just funny, you know, and I love puns. I love them. And so, you know, whenever you could have somebody who would work with that wordplay, it was just a hoot.
It's so good. It's so good. I mean, wordplay takes a certain intelligence. You have to know the words, first of all. You have to know how to use them. And he did that really well. Now I'm getting all nostalgic. I'll have to go back. So at 20, you said you want to write a book. I feel like this is something that's quite common among those of us called to write, but that it's also very common that we decide we actually need a job. So, so did you become a teacher because that's what you were studying in college? Were you studying education?
And I think it's almost like being a writing fangirl, you know, because I could be in the world of words, in the world of literature, and talking about literature with my students, you know, and I love to write poetry, just working with the written word and then watching it bloom in other kids and then helping other people with their work. But it's just kind of it's kind of like wearing the big Chiefs t-shirt or something with, you know, the quarterback name on the back. You know, it's this identifying with a world that you really admire and love, but you don't feel any eligibility for. And I think it took me a long time just to give it a shot and realize that the only way, and age will do this to you too, but to realize that the only way you're not going to succeed at something doesn't mean you have to succeed commercially, but is if you don't try it, is if you don't make the attempt. So it was very, very worthwhile. Learned a lot.
So I think just for any younger, especially women listening, I think it's the best thing, honestly, to hit 40 because you just start to not care about the things, the fame or the, you're just like, I'm just gonna have a good time doing whatever I want to. And I remember my grandmother telling me that, and I did not get it. I didn't get it until I went past 40 and was like, I'm just having, I think I'm just gonna do whatever I want to do. And I don't, I hope that it entertains you, but if it doesn't, I'm gonna do it anyway. Like you just sort of stop caring. Which is
Well,
it.
and you become more intact in the process, don't you think? You know, you're completed in your certainty that this is who I am, this is what I want to do, and you aren't just parsing out yourself to satisfy the whims of a fickle world, you know.
And I do think young women have it harder these days because we didn't have Instagram and we didn't have the selfies, to, and that sort of comparison maybe. On one hand, I envy them that they are so comfortable in front of the camera. I think there's like a definite delineation on the generations of the women who are like, oh, camera time, versus like the young people. But at the same time, I say that I have three girls, and I'm like, you don't, you cannot believe everything that's happening this over here, like behind just on this picture here, and you cannot compare yourself, and that's hard. I mean, you can say that a million times, but I do think they have more pressure. They see everyone else.
Well, and as we're in this transition time where AI is coming, you know, coming into its own, I think it will be useful as they start to realize the capabilities to absolutely create a false reality on AI. And so to look at what they're seeing and to have it give them pause. Think about it. Question whether it is actually true.
Which I would say makes our job more important than ever to write stories. And I know that you write what we would call women's fiction. We were talking about this beforehand. And I guess to me, women's fiction is something that's not as plot oriented as it is focused on the character and the character arc. Do you think that, or what is your idea of women's fiction?
You know, there's a lot of internal stuff in women's fiction, which, and my point of view, the point of view in which I write is either first person or a close third, because you do want to be in their heads. But I like to think that what I write is, and it's a term that hasn't really caught on in everywhere, but I like the term in that it's the term upmarket fiction.
Okay.
Because it's character driven, but it still has a compelling plot. So you're not just rattling around in someone's head, and hopefully you can create pacing and tension that has it be a page turner while your readers are entering the lives of these characters. But I think women's fiction really has the opportunity for those of us at whatever stage of life we're in to enter the life of a woman as she processes real life events. And more exciting they can be, the better the book is, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not always the case. And sometimes the issues are issues with, you know, personal value, worth, identity, you know, the things we've been told, what's true, what's false, how do we get around that, you know? But I guess I think you can tell the truth better with fiction than almost anything, or not better, but you can really tell the truth in fiction through the expression of these human lives. And
it's not as intense, right? I mean, we're living in a time where everyone always somehow feels like they need to argue. And I feel like fiction is a way where we come without our armor and our swords, you know, we're ready to, it's like, it's that internal piece of us that we're created to just be drawn to stories. Like, we just love stories as humans. Like, you just can't get, whether it's through music, through movies, through books, through the anecdotes at the dinner table, we're just created to enjoy a good story. And so fiction is like, you feel like someone's telling you to do something, you know, and as Americans, we don't like that. We're going to naturally rebel, right? And, or you can bring up issues in fiction that I think that most of us would come ready to do battle if it was like nonfiction. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I try to have my characters be very apolitical and yet still express issues of the heart that are relevant to us all.
Yeah.
And so that can be really disarming then too, because you've got somebody, they're just coming alongside somebody else in their lives. And the more unusual the character, it can give you a little bit of a disconnect. And yet, if you can layer these characters, the themes will penetrate your readers so that it is as if they have experienced the situation themselves. So that's a goal, you know.
But yeah, that is
left brain stuff, right? That's left brain. And when you sit down to write, you're not your left brain, you just gotta kind of send her off to the woods somewhere.
Yes. And then sort of bring her back with your editor and then go back. Yeah, it's a delicate balance, isn't it? But when you decided to sit down and write, did you have a story in mind, or did you decide, like, what came first? Did you start writing, or did you start going to learn the craft, or how was that first sit down?
I don't have a, my brain doesn't work in a line at all. I'm not linear. And so concepts arrive, and I've used this illustration before, but I think it really applies to me. And as a photographer, it makes a lot of sense to me in that I'll have all of these components and then they'll all snap into focus, you know? And so then there's the story. And some of the pieces that came to be came through a writing class that I took online. And I was in a group that they gave us some prompts, or they had a list of prompts, and one was a fire and one was a girl. And so I wrote this sketch about a little girl who accidentally lights a fire and then she escapes into the woods. And because my soul is nourished through the created world, and you know, it's God's first book, you know, and I feel like the natural world expresses the character of God. And so I know that my setting, that's where I want to spend my time. So I know that whatever I'm going to be writing is going to be set in the natural world, because I'm going to be spending a year or more in that setting, and that's where I want to be. So when I wrote this story, I sent this little girl into a riparian corridor in the Pacific Northwest, and it was just a sketch. And I sent it into to the instructor, and then the cadre of folks who were in the class responded to it too. But they started writing to me and they said, "We really want to know where this story goes. What are you going to do with this?" And I thought, "Do with it? I was just writing a sketch."
Just doing my homework. What do you mean?
Yeah. But it wasn't too long before, before really I have to very intentionally set my inner editor aside, because my inner editor is real noisy and real bossy, and she's really useful when I'm needing to edit. But when I'm creating, I just need to just say, go do something. And then I started dreaming about this little girl, and I started, and so I would get up and jot notes, and I just had papers, notes all over the place. And eventually the story emerged. But it's a beautiful synergy of possibilities, I think, when you open your mind to allow imparted ideas, and then watch what happens. And I feel like I'm a scribe, one of these old scribes, or like I'm a UPS girl or something, because I'm recording these ideas as they come, and then they take shape. But the character, have you found with your writing that the characters tell you what they want you to do? You know, I mean, if you're a pure plotter, you're going to have everything all laid out. But if you're in a hybrid, your characters are, they have a voice, and it's not yours.
I think if you give them time, that's why I tell anyone who will listen that you have to spend that time thinking, because and sometimes it happens with the writing where if you're so deep in the writing that a lot of times the scene will come out and you're like, I have no idea where that came from. And I think that's your right side of the brain just taking over. But especially if you have like I have teenagers and preteens, so you know, that chunk of time might not be as long as I wish it was. So I think if I sit and think about them, they will tell me this, what you have planned, quote unquote, is not going to work. This is what has to happen. And it's amazing. And I do think that that's one trick or talent that people who are storytellers, if you allow that to develop, that is the talent there. If you let those characters lead the way and you just write the story. But either way, whether you're able to like have that time writing and it's your right side of the brain, or if you're thinking, I mean, I go take hikes and think, okay, how would she do this? And eventually if I just dream them, you know, sort of daydream into them, you're like, oh, okay, this is what we're going to do. Now I got to get home and write it.
And it comes, and mowing the lawn is a really good way to get those ideas too, because you're, I have actually stopped the mower 5 or 6 times and gone and jotted down things that came to me when I'm just about to hit a branch going under a tree or something. I don't know.
Like, I better pay attention.
Yeah.
The mundane tasks are fabulous. Sometimes I find myself putting my headphones in, my AirPods or whatever, and never turning anything on because my brain will start thinking of something else. All the thousands of laundry, you know, baskets that I have with basketball players and volleyball players in my house, laundry is a fabulous way to think of, like, I know some people who actually dictate while they're doing laundry, but I have teenage girls, and I've had several videos taken of me and, you know, doing like disciplining the dog. I feel like they would probably spy on me and take videos of me dictating into my phone or something. Just, you know, anything to get a laugh at mom's expense. But
I love that.
So when did Sugar Birds come out, and how long did it take you to write it once you sort of had that idea or the story?
You know, I looked at pictures the other day, and I finished the first manuscript, and it was originally called something else, and I thought it was going to be a YA piece. That's another thread we could talk about. But I spent a few years on it, and then when I first wrote, when I was writing long form nonfiction, the first book that I wrote came out of a column that I wrote for Women of Faith. I don't know if you know those conferences. And And so at one point, that platform had it was right at the turn, right around 1999, 2000, when those conferences were really big. And at one point, those conferences had a million, the page had a million down views a month,
Wow.
downloads a month. And I didn't even understand platform. We didn't understand what was going to be happening with any of that. So that book and the next book came out in 2001 and 2003. And then the dot-com crash happened in 2001, and that platform went away. And so when I started writing, there is a thread to this, but so when I started writing fiction, I didn't have a platform anymore because I had experienced some griefs and had gone off and done some other things and had helped other people with their writing, but I wasn't actively writing or submitting at that point. And so I was basically starting from zero. So I published Sugar Birds Indie and learned a ton, had a marvelous experience, and the book took off and it was having a good run. And then an agent, a wonderful agent that I had connected with a few years earlier, circled back around to me and we started talking, and she found a contract for Sugar Birds. And because it was a hybrid book, I had retained the rights to it. So Tyndale bought Sugar Birds and then gave me a contract for two more books. So that,
Wow,
you
is
know,
that common?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't know whether
I took it.
well, the acquisition, but it's very thrilling because I'm not such an unusual person. And I mean, I guess knowing that that route is there and that it's possible, I think we have to dream about these things. And that was one thing that my agent was really good about. She says, so, and that's what she asked me. She says, what would your dream be? I said, my dream would be to sell Sugar Birds and then to be able to keep writing stories like this. And she made it happen.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
How has your experience been then compared to indie publishing versus having a, is Tyndale a full publishing house or is it a hybrid? It is hybrid?
No, it's a large Christian publishing house. Yeah.
So how has your experience been, like what are the major differences, I guess, as an author?
You know, I worked with She Writes Press as a hybrid, and they have a stellar design team, and they're pros. They know what they're doing. They're very good at what they do, and they showcase this book in the most beautiful way in terms of their presentation and the formatting. And I just can't say enough about that. That said, as a hybrid participant, all the marketing, you know, if you're going to have a publicist, you've got to hire your publicist. If you're going to be, you know, you're on, you know, you've got skin in the game. But that was really, I viewed it as an offering because I knew that, you know, it's very difficult for publishers to take a chance on a first-time novelist. And, you know, I was starting from scratch. And yet I felt that the message of the book and the story in the book and the hope in it, really, I really wanted it to be out there, and I wanted it as an offering to my newborn granddaughter, my first grandchild. And so it was an offering for me. So I viewed that my investment in the book as an offering, and you know, it ended up working out really well. But we pulled it right in the middle of that first run. And then it went back into production at Tyndale, and they used the same cover image, and you know, which is really a tribute to the cover design, you know, that had been already done on it. And then it was re-released this last October, and then the new book Leaning on Air comes out in May. So did I answer your question? I don't know if I did.
But so you're saying a lot of, as much as She Writes Press and probably the other hybrids, they will help you with the cover art and their expertise, especially like that's very nice, because even if you are if you're full indie where you don't go with a hybrid, you will approach a book designer and they'll ask you, what do you want? And I think that really
Right.
makes you freeze, because you're like, I don't know, I'm a writer, not a designer. So they definitely help you with that sort of
Well,
expertise.
and so much more too, you know, all of the placements, the online placements at the retailer, And some hybrids have a presence in indie books, you know, in bookstores, and some don't get your, but you still have to have a very active marketing presence as an author. But and this is a continues the answer to your question, is that I've really developed some understanding of what my role could be and how I could augment whatever the publisher was doing. And for my first two books, they published it. You know, you do some appearances or some interviews. You know, if they ask you to do, I just felt that I was much more passive on those first two books. And this is a tough industry, and these publishers are doing their best to get your work out there, but they really need author participation. And so, even though we would just love to be able to be in our cloistered environment writing, you know, we need to be really involved in what they're trying to accomplish to get the word out on these books too. And so I left this hybrid and came into this beautiful family at Tyndale, where I just couldn't be happier, you know. And so I
That's
feel like a little bit like I was driving a jalopy, you know, and cranking the engine to get it going. Not as a statement to my publisher, but just that there was so much on me as a hybrid. As a hybrid author, that now I sometimes get to sit in this limo because they're doing some of this stuff that I had to do before, and it's really quite wonderful. So, but it maximizes your time, and then you also have,
That's what I was going to say. It maximizes your time more than anything to
yeah.
then be able to assist with the marketing, right? And to have that energy to continue
Yes.
your platform.
Yes, and then to have people who have who are wise and experienced, and you know, and steeped in hope in this environment. I just can't say enough about them. It's been
Yeah,
marvelous.
that's very cool. I'm glad to hear that. I was reading this morning an article from Vox of this author that was just very upset about needing an author platform, and then of course the author world responded, and Jane Friedman responded, and there are definite thoughts on it. And yes, most of us are introverts, and we would prefer to sort of be in our cave. But to me, it's like, well, it's like anything in life. You can decide that it's horrible, or you can decide like, well, let's find some of the fun, you know, in this and figure out how to do this. Because like you said, like it's great that the sort of the gatekeepers have been moved away, and they don't, it's not just a small portion of society getting published. At the same time, that also means that there's only so much time that the publishers have to market you, right? So the more that you can be out there talking about your book, obviously the more people are going to know about it. There's 8 billion people in the world. You know, they're not always going to know everything, especially when Taylor Swift is the headliner for everything you say.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like, yeah,
No.
but do you want to read a book here?
But you figure, you know, there are what do they say, 1 million books published in the US a year? Is that right?
That's what they say.
That's pretty crowded, noisy clamor out there. So, you know, I guess I trust that God's going to take this book where these books where he will, and they'll land in the hands where they're supposed to. And so then that can take off some of the pressure. But I think that in platform creation, I like to think that I hope that I give more than I want my platform to be an offering too. And because I'm a photographer, I put a lot of nature photography and then my observations on it, and sometimes scripture or whatever. But I feel like it can be a point of engagement. And even though social media, say what you will about it, has a lot of downsides to it, it's also can also be a real place of peace and connection. And there are a lot of people who are really lonely right now, and who are isolated, or who are in situations that are really untenable. And to be able to, in whatever little piece of the world you've landed, to be able to offer some hope there is really a joyful thing for me, you know. And as an author, I guess I don't, and in my worldview, I don't believe that I believe that every single story has the possibility to be a happy ending, to have a happy ending.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a sugar-coated Pollyanna la-la sort of, pie in the sky attitude,
Right.
But if we take the really long view, there are choices available to every one of us to have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helps me in writing these stories, because there are dark things that happen to people and very hard things that happen, and life circumstances and relationships and things that make absolutely no sense. But if you cut the story off at the 75% mark, you're not going to have that happy ending. And
Right.
so if you look at a story arc, very oftentimes that 75% mark is the all is lost
Yes.
moment,
Yeah.
and I have started to think about to watch lives like that, and when people are ready to give up hope, I say, no, you're only at the 75%,
I like that.
And when you really can't see your way out of, the death of loved ones, or a loss that's so horrific that you can't ever imagine that there will be any justice in it, you're only at 75%.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. So is that sort of worldview is shown in your books then too, as you, I know we were talking before, like you're published through Tyndale, which is a Christian publisher, but we were talking kind of about writing books with our own worldview, with our belief system, but not having them, as you said before, kind of sugarcoated. Like they're not, because life is not like that. And so like, how would you consider your books Christian fiction, or whatever that sort of means, or do your books deal with this idea of there are dark things that happen to people, and there is sort of an infusion of hope in there?
Yeah, because it is how I see the world, and every author's going to write from their worldview.
Yeah.
And I'm a Christ follower who writes fiction. I don't see myself as an author of Christian fiction. But Sugarbirds launched in the general market, and that's where it found its way before it moved into the Christian market. And then once it had been in some competitions and had won some awards in the secular market. And then once it, Christianity Today took notice of the book and gave it an award of merit. And then it was in the Christies and, won a Carol, and it was a Christie finalist. And so, but the recognition of the book at those locations gave it, movement, began to give it movement in the Christian market. And then at that point, Tyndale had picked it up and then re-released it.
Mm-hmm.
So while these books are moving in the Christian market, and Leaning on Air is launching in the Christian market, it's my prayer that they'll be cross-market. And those who don't share my worldview, who have read the book, will recognize that there are spiritual themes in these books. And there are some characters in the book who follow Christ. Not everybody does. And the stuff that they face isn't sugarcoated. And I do get some letters saying, why did you have that happen? How could you have that happen? And I'm thinking, because it happens.
Because it's real life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the problems with Christian fiction, and it will probably come to a reckoning at some point, because I've had this conversation with many people in the Christian fiction reader or writer's sphere, of the sort of rules, the unspoken rules that are placed on that fiction. And I don't know one author personally who doesn't say, I am a Christian who writes fiction. Most don't want the label of Christian fiction, because it gives that idea of everything's too easy, sort of. That's my feeling. Like it wraps up too easily. It doesn't take seriously the story structure that we live in. Like we have story structure because that is actual real life structure. Like you say, like this, it's innate in us. And I don't think it does any favors to Christian fiction to sort of cut that short.
Yeah. And to the publisher's credit, I think there's, and I'm, I'm not an expert on the history of Christian publishing, but there's been a huge amount of movement in the industry. And everything that I've seen at Tyndale is that they are looking for beautifully crafted, thoughtful fiction that has relevance to every life. And then, you know, there will be varying degrees in the books that they publish, depending on what an author interest is. But lots of times you can even tell by covers. Mm-hmm. You can tell by, there are just lots of ways that you can tell the context of engagement with light and dark.
Yeah.
In your story.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Right. And I hope, like, I read books by authors whose worldviews I don't share. So I would hope that that wouldn't stop anyone from picking up books. And I think fiction can challenge us in a lot of things and have us understand humans better, which is always a plus, right? So, but what about Leaning on Air? Sugarbirds is about this little girl, but Leaning on Air, what is that about? That's the one coming out this week as the podcast drops.
Right. Sugarbirds, the key characters in there are Celia and Aggie. And Aggie's the little girl who hides in the woods. The girl who finds her is Celia, who's a 16-year-old, and she strikes up a friendship with two young men in the story. One of them's dangerous, and she becomes romantically involved with him. And then there's this autistic kid named Burnaby Hayes, he's an autistic savant. He's artistic. He's really an intriguing character, but his neurodivergence hasn't, at this point in his life, he's still very compromised socially, relationally. So 12 years later, in Leaning on Air, I have a chance meeting on a country road with Celia and Burnaby, who are both professionals now. Celia is a hawk researcher, and Burnaby is just about to start his position. He's just finished at MIT in Cornell Veterinary School, and he's accepted a position at Washington State University as a veterinary surgeon and a professor at the school there. And so they dive into this whirlwind romance, but you'll get the backstory on what makes it even possible for him to have been with her. But he can't be touched. He can't be surprised by touch. He's very principled. He's very loving. He's creative. He's this amazing guy, but he's got these sensory neurons as an autistic man that he's surprised by touch. He just shrinks and freezes from her. And she's very passionate. She's been down the road. She's had a lot of relationships. She's jaundiced. Her only faith persuasion is that she loves science. And yet he captures her. And so they fall into this very unusual romance, whirlwind marriage, ill-equipped. And then the inciting incident happens after they've been married about 10 years. And it sends them down this road where you just don't know if the relationship's going to survive, but it has all sorts of mystery and intrigue. And it's set in the Palouse in wheat country. And I love the story. I love those characters. I was sad to write the last chapter. And I'm hearing that from advanced readers that they're pretty excited about it. So
Is the third book going to follow them as well?
No, the third book is actually, I turned it in just before Christmas, and it is a new couple. It's another love story, but it's set around the generational strongholds, and the nature parallel for it is the removal of the two dams on the Elwha River on the Olympic Peninsula. And it's this wild river that's in Olympic National Park, and I like that story. It was the hardest one to write because it enters spiritual realms that will give readers pause, I think. So
interesting. So I love how you're able to mesh your passions too, like to bring in your passion for nature and sciences into the books. Like, do you do that purposely where the characters are or they work in fields that fascinate you or that you know a lot about, or do they sort of come together like that, maybe subconsciously?
Well, I love science, and I believe that, as I had shared earlier, that science illustrates the character of God. And so there's stuff in Leaning on Air that Burnaby, where Burnaby's faith grows through quantum entanglement in physics, and he has an understanding of marriage and of prayer through physics.
Interesting.
I think it will be fresh. I hope, as you read it, that readers will read things they haven't read before.
Yeah. I
And
once heard that there is, it was a neurophysicist speaking. I think it was a TED Talk or a podcast because I do a lot of, I like to input a lot. And he said he doesn't think there is one neurophysicist that doesn't believe in a higher power, because you just can't, or a quantum physicist as well. Like, you just can't get to that point and believe that there isn't something beyond, which I found very interesting, because I don't think that is widely understood. It was the first time I had heard it.
right. Well, you think about classical physics, and classical physics, by and large, has absolutes. But when you move into the realm of quantum physics, uncertainty and the unprovable nature of some of the premises, it's part of what you've got. And Einstein called the whole concept of quantum entanglement spooky action at a distance.
Oh, really?
Because his whole deal was that nothing can move faster than the speed of light. And
Yeah.
yet here you have, in the whole principle of quantum entanglement, you can have particles that, once entangled, separated even to the farthest ends of the universe, you can have one particle move and the other responds instantly, not at the speed of light, but instantly. And experimental physicists have proven this. But anyway, Burnaby in the story ties quantum entanglement to how he has felt for Celia, how he's felt about Celia all these years. And then, it just unwinds, and Celia doesn't get it. She doesn't get it. And yet their relationship and their marriage, through periods of separation and loss and all kinds of stuff, you continue to see these principles of quantum
Yeah.
entanglement that are just so cool. So
That's
circling
very cool.
back, well, you know, but circling back around to your question on how these, what do I write about? Do you remember the movie Chariots of Fire? Did you ever see that movie?
Yes. Oh, yes.
There's the theme song has this rhythmic undercurrent, and then this lilt up above
Yeah.
it. And I guess I always look for the lilt in the story, because we have this mundane nature of life and all of the things that happen, all the drama, and then there's this beautiful lilt and light. And as a photographer, light has a huge impact on everything I do. I mean, a picture isn't a picture without the right light. You need the light, but the light is not something you can control. You can only try to capture it, and you can capture it in photographs and in story and in life and in worldview. And so I always pick the setting before I write a story. I know where it's going to take place, because it's a place where the lilt has caught my heart or my soul. And then I take the characters into that, and then the magic starts happening.
I
So
love that. I love that. I really am enjoying the last few interviews I've done. It's they've all been female writers except for one man, but there's like this ability and this moment in which these writers have figured out how to bring together their passions and how to put it into story. And I love how you're saying it's that lilt, it's that light. Everyone has a different way of getting there, but I think that's really kind of what it's meant by write what you know. And I think that that doesn't give it credit. It's like write what is like burns inside of you. And you just have to find that way to put them together without it feeling sort of like you're cramming it.
Right.
But
Well,
I.
have you seen stuff, a cat where where they say, well, you know, figure out what the market's asking for, write to the market.
Yeah.
Oh, no, no, no. I
No.
mean, at least for me, I couldn't do it because I guess I'm easily distracted. You know, I can be as intensely focused as I need to be and
And miss
give.
the market moment. Like, oh, that was a year ago. Wait up.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, and I'm willing. But I'm saying that I'm willing to give the time
Yeah.
to create that it takes. I don't cut corners, but don't put me in a place where I'm writing to somebody else's market, because I'm trying to listen to what God would have me write, and whatever ideas He gives me, I'm not going to modify those or
Yeah.
compromise for the sake of a fickle market, because the markets are fickle.
Yeah, I also think that we've given away our agency as writers when we say that. As writers and artists are always sort of at the head of culture, and when you give away your agency, you're allowing something else to fill that spot. And we all know when there's a vacuum, something will fill it. And it is human nature to want to consume the same thing. You want it, you eat a chocolate, you want five more, but there is a point at which you go, I will vomit if I eat another chocolate.
Yeah.
And then you're looking for someone to say, usually mom, have an apple. You'll
Yeah.
feel better. So
Yeah.
there's on one hand, I don't want to make anyone mad, whatever, you know. Yes, there's a, you know, a certain type of writing to market. Like if you write thrillers, if you're Grisham or whatever, there is that type there, but also to not, I don't want writers to feel like they have to run after a trend, because most likely people will be saturated by the time you get there. And then you will be that chocolate that makes them vomit. And then you have spent your time not writing what you want to write or what you want to say. And I don't know. I just think life is too short. And this is probably, you know, I'm beyond 40. So what do I care? I'm no longer in that moment of like, it's too short to spend time on a book that saying something that you don't care that much about, or that you don't look back on and say, yeah, I tried to say something and I did my best of trying to make a statement about love, marriage, you know, children, nature, God, whatever it is. Or no, I watered it down to sell it to market. Like, let me tell you, that won't guarantee anything. It will not guarantee sales. So that's just.
But some of that's for the process of self-discovery too, don't you
Yeah.
think?
Yeah.
Well,
Of course, we all got to go through that.
Yeah. You have this spark in you that where you know that you love the written word and you want, and so you discover an author that you really like and you try to emulate their style or whatever, but there's an assembly of pieces going on within us, you know, parts of who we are and what are, you know, our the things that we're learning about ourselves, and that's all going to develop and emerge in our writing too. But I think there are a lot of novels or a lot of books that can be written early on when we aren't yet all the ages that we'll ever be, and that really stay in the drawer as part of the growth.
That's true. Well, and even if they, you know, I have a few in the drawer that will never come out. And then even if they do get published, like you are the age that you are and you have the life experience that you have, I would just not personally give the advice. If an author were to ask me, should I write to market or should I write what I'm passionate about? I think the reader knows. I think they can tell, they can feel the difference when you really want to give credence to your characters and a worldview and you're trying to dive deep into humanity. I think a reader knows it. And hey, we all want a beach read every once in a while, and that's fine too. But I think the books that stick with us.
Well, and one more thought too, just about the power and the redemptive value of pain. Author has experienced difficulty and is not just giving it headspace. You know, when they've lived it, then you've got an integration of, even if the pain you're writing about isn't the particular pain that you've experienced, you have a visceral experience of suffering or of pain or of confusion or of loss that you're able to convey in your characters that readers know is authentic.
Yeah.
If you do it well. And that's what we want. We want it to be an authentic experience for people so that something happens that is an intangible that I can't predict what will happen in you when you read my stories, just as you can't predict how I will receive yours, but something will happen if it's
Yeah.
authentic.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. This sounds like a really intriguing story. But do people need to read Sugar Birds before they read Leaning on Air?
No, it's a stand. It works
It's a
very well as
standalone.
a standalone. You know, there are
Okay.
references earlier, and if you knew the characters, you go, "Oh, there she is," or whatever. But you could handily pick it up as a standalone. And I've, you know, it's gone out to early reviewers. It's been on NetGalley, and I have people who have picked up Leaning on Air and read it, and then run back and grab Sugar Birds because they want to find the backstory on
Oh,
these.
that's always wonderful.
Yeah, so that's been fun. But yeah, I hope it carries you away.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So it is out this week. Is there anywhere in particular that they can find it? Is it only on Amazon or is it wide?
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Okay. So we will have the links in the show notes below. I'll also have links to Cheryl Gray Bostrom. Do you want to? You definitely want to Google Cheryl Gray Bostrom because there are two authors as Cheryl Bostrom. So we'll have the correct links below. And if you end up on the other Cheryl Bostroms, just say hey, just give a kind wave. But we'll have the links below where you can find Leaning on Air and you can find Sugar Birds. And we'll be waiting for your third one coming out, I guess, next year, right?
Yeah, 25, May of 25.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Cheryl, for coming on and talking to us about your writing journey.
Thank you for having me. Fun to tap talk.